this week on Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
But I actually do want to engage with them. I think the engagement is what's missing. But part of the underlying ideology of contemporary DEI, critical social justice, part of that ideology is not giving the other side the time of day.
Attention passengers, we ask that you please fasten your seatbelts at this time and secure all baggage underneath your seat or in the overhead compartments. Flyover Country with Scott Jennings is prepared for takeoff.
This is Flyover Country with Scott Jennings. I'm your host, Joe Arnold. Scott Jennings is the real host, but I say round table, but you're the only person at the table, Scott.
Yeah, and the table is a rectangle at that. So I,
what a busy week! By the way, coming up the second half, or the majority of this podcast is going to be dedicated to a conversation with Dr. Eric Smith at the Cato Institute, professor of rhetoric at York, Pennsylvania, University of York College of Pennsylvania. But the he is just a crusader on the world of free thought in academia and taking aim at some of the DEI initiatives that have kind of derailed that very principle and America's educational institutions. Looking forward to that, Scott, but busy week in the meantime. I want to immediately get to, I think you may have gotten President Biden impeached.
What?
You and David Axelrod, and with after Aaron Burnett interviewed President Biden this past week in Milwaukee, you were up in Milwaukee there on the waterfront there, and brought up this concept of by Biden withholding military aid to Israel in the face of these campus protests and the uproar within the Democratic Party. You make the point, but it's amazing what happened after you said this on CNN a few nights ago.
Well, first of all, it was incredible to be up there. Let me say a couple of things about the interview. Number one, I thought Aaron Burnett did an excellent job. Aaron is, if you haven't watched it in its entirety, you really should, because she was very, very straightforward with Biden about the economy, the economic indicators, how people feel about it. I mean, she really let him have it. And of course, you know, he denied it and said some very untrue things, as he almost always does about the economy. To me, though, as you pointed out, the biggest news was what he said about Israel. And, you know, it was with Aaron that he made the statement that we're going to continue withholding weapons that they don't want used in the invasion of Rafah. And I pointed out on the show that the first impeachment of Donald Trump was this issue. He withheld congressionally approved military aid from Ukraine, the Democrats argued, for political purposes. That was the core of the impeachment. And I've made the point that right now, Joe Biden is withholding congressionally authorized military aid from our ally, Israel, because he's worried about what this is doing to his reelection campaign. He wants Israel to stop finishing the job against Hamas, because I guess he's spooked by all these protests on college campuses and he's worried about what his base thinks. I see no difference. Now, Axe, who, as you know, I adore and I consider to be my good friend, and I love David Axelrod, did not agree with me, and you can listen to it. We uploaded it into the pod, and he said that he couldn't even understand the comparison. The analogy is not the same. The comparison is not the same. But I don't know what the difference is, Joe. I mean, you've got a president dealing with an ally in a war. You have the U.S. Congress that voted on and passed a law authorizing military aid for that ally, and it's being withheld, obviously, for political reasons. And so, to me, it's a pretty obvious what's good for the goose situation. Democrats don't see it that way, but I've noticed more than a handful of Republicans in Congress see it that way. Now, you mentioned Tom Cotton. I mean, I told Axe the other night, look, I didn't invent this. Like, all the rules that we're currently playing by are rules that Democrats invented for Donald Trump. I'm just trying to enforce them for everyone else. And the current president is Joe Biden. And that has to do with this issue, has to do with lying, has to do with, you know, the idea of being a dictator. Well, I mean, what's more dictatorial than Joe Biden, you know, bragging about evading the Supreme Court? I mean, all the rules they set up for Trump, they refuse to abide by themselves for Biden.
Of course, the pushback that he said on the air is that the difference is that Trump was trying to coerce Ukraine into providing basically prosecuting someone within Ukraine that are, and basically trying to attack Joe Biden in the process.
Okay, but Joe Biden is trying to coerce Israel into stopping a tactic in a war, in this case, the assault on Rafah, that, by the way, must occur for Israel to win this war and to finish it. He's doing it for one reason and one reason only, to enhance his political position with Democrats. I mean, look, you can believe, and I think this is the core of it. Democrats hate Donald Trump so much that when he does something that is inherently political, they view it as criminal. Mm-hmm. But when Joe Biden does something that is inherently political, like he is in this case, they view it as justified in the pursuit of getting rid of Donald Trump. And so if you believe that, then you can start to, you know, allow just about anything. Well, you know, it was rough. That was rough stuff. But, you know, we got to get rid of Trump. So, like, you can justify almost any action, even if it's hypocritical, based on the rules you set up for the previous president. I mean, it's not a good look, in my opinion. And by the way, there's been a bunch of Democrats in Congress and elsewhere that have come out and said Joe Biden is wrong to do this. Virtually every mainstream Jewish organization in this country has put out statements condemning Joe Biden over this. He's prolonging the war. Right. And taking away bombs and artillery shells means more hand-to-hand fighting on the ground. And what that means, of course, is more dead Israeli soldiers. That's what it means.
Well, and a less stable Middle East. I mean, there's no question. That's that, of course. And you did everything you could and did an awesome job on CNN to counter the overall narrative of what came out of that interview. But the thing that frustrates me the most on all of the mass media coverage of all of this is that we focus on are American weapons being used in the fight against Hamas? And as a result, are some civilians being killed in the process? Yes, those are all true. But the point of all of this is all on Hamas.
Yes.
None of this would be necessary. Israel's security, Israel's very existence is dependent upon the elimination of the terrorist group who is sworn for all time to eradicate Israel from the map.
Well, they have said, Joe Biden has said that, I mean, effectively he blames Israel for civilian deaths, and he often parrots this Hamas propaganda about the numbers of civilian deaths, which, by the way, statistically have been totally debunked by statisticians and academics that have looked at this. Hamas makes up numbers. They then get parroted by Joe Biden and his people, and it becomes just part of the, you know, the mainstream coverage of this. It's not true. That's number one. But number two, if a single civilian has been killed, and I have no doubt that they have, it's not the fault of an American weapon. It's not the fault of Israel. It is the fault of Hamas that started this war and uses civilians as human shields. It is their fault. It is their fault. And they will not stop unless they are eliminated, every single one. I mean, Israel has said, never again. That's their right. slogan for this war. But you can't have never again if you leave these people alive. And what I interpret Joe Biden's position here is, well, we're going to leave some of them alive. We just have to.
And this
That's
whole
not acceptable
this past
to Israel.
Week, and I know we don't have much more time on it, but just to say, this whole concept this past week, too, where and it's crazy how the media jumps on, like, Hamas has agreed to a ceasefire. Well, no, Hamas agreed to what they want to agree to.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, they want a ceasefire because they want Israel to stop going after them from performing as a terrorist organization.
Yeah, look, the disposition of most people in the media is that Israel is the bad guy. They have believed it from day one. They have believed Hamas propaganda. There is an anti-Semitism to this coverage. Most of it is geared towards believing that Israel is the bad guy. And then, by definition, anyone who helps Israel, so if the United States sends Israel weapons or whatever, we're the bad guy. And how did we get to a place where these terrorists who raped and murdered and kidnapped all these people are somehow the sympathetic ones? They're somehow the good guy. But it's so pervasive that that's what all these kids on these college campuses believe. Israel is bad. The United States is bad. Western civilization is bad. And Let's put Hamas in charge for a while and see how that goes. I mean, that's effectively what they want. They're not anti-war and they're not pro-Palestinian. They're pro-Hamas. They're pro-war. They're anti-Semitic. They're anti-American and they're anti-Western civilization. But make no mistake, they want a war. They just want Hamas to win it.
Before we get to take the break, let me follow up on at least one other element of the interview of Joe Biden by Aaron Burnett on CNN. What you were on the live broadcast, the follow-up to that in Milwaukee this past week. And that is, as you put it, the president's whining about and I guess questioning CNN's poll methodology. Now, you know that I've gotten burned as a journalist in the past with some pretty bad polling. So I'm not one to stand up and say, oh, polling is right. But generally speaking, he does. It seems to me that he doesn't want to look at any metric which is potentially negative in his direction in a political sense.
Well, every piece of information that Aaron Burnett presented him with, whether it was poll information or economic data, he denied it and then made some false statement about it and sloughed it off. And it was extraordinarily arrogant, I thought. I thought his messaging was way off. And actually, Jared, let's play my colleague David Axelrod, what he had to say about his reaction to Joe Biden's comments on the economy.
I don't understand this. I don't understand all these months later. You know, I thought they spent $25 million mistakenly last fall touting Bidenomics and making the same argument that the president's making here. It is absolutely true. The world was plunged into an economic crisis and America was plunged into an economic crisis by the pandemic. And we've come back faster than almost any other country. And he's right about that. But that's not the way people are experiencing the economy. They're experiencing it through the lens of the cost of living. And he is a man who's built his career on empathy. Why not lead with the empathy? And I think he's making a terrible mistake. You know, it may not be, if he doesn't win this race, it may not be Donald Trump that beats him. It may be his own pride.
So David Axelrod was, Joe,
not empathetic.
I mean, yeah. I mean, and I've heard from more than a handful of people in Democratic circles since this all happened that they thought Biden was way off base and not understanding how he's going to have to talk to the American people. People are hurting. Inflation is bad. And he seems to just not get it. Now, Axe and I disagreed on Israel, of course, but I agreed with him about the economic messaging. And we'll play this from Fox News, who did an analysis of the president's remarks. And they found that he, I think, told like 15 lies in 17 minutes, Jared, during the interview.
President Biden had a rare sit-down interview this week with CNN. If you saw it, you may have watched it yourself. He set quite the record. The New York Post reports this. In a brief 17 minutes, Biden told 15 lies, nearly a lie a minute. From whoppers about the economy to prevarications on Israel, Biden spun a fantasy land of a presidency that voters know is false. So what we want to do is put it all together, all right? So on screen, you'll see all 15 that the New York Post lists here. I don't know what you favor, Martha. Lie one is I've created 15 million jobs since I've been president. Problem is that all those jobs came back because COVID went away and you had the vaccine. How about number eight? Inflation was 9% when I came to office?
Nope.
That's right. and on it went. There it is right there. 9% when it came to office.
1.4% when he came into office, which is, you know, the Fed target area. So that's a healthy place. That's where you want to be.
So when presented, Joe, with information that contradicts his narrative, Biden gets angry. I mean, he got upset about the polling. He told falsehoods about the economy. He went back to the old canard about Snickers, you know. Well, you know, the Snickers. I mean, it was like listening to someone sitting at like a, you know, like a Hardee's at 3 p.m, just like shaking their fist at the clouds. I mean, it really was. I mean, honestly, it was sad. He was weak on Israel. He was weak on the economy. He whined to Aaron about the polling. Just the whole thing was, it was pretty sad. I mean, my view is he doesn't do enough mainstream media interviews, but after having watched it, I understand why they don't, because that was, I mean, don't you think that was probably a net negative for him?
Yes, I was just trying to think about who's he trying to reach. I think ultimately, because he capitulated to the campus protests and to the progressive left on Israel. They might consider this to be a shoring up that portion of their base, you know, so that would be considered to be a positive in that regard. But in terms of swing states and the people who are going to decide the election, I would not think so.
I don't think there's anything politically smart about this, because I don't think the people on college campuses are going to give him any credit for anything. I mean, they're calling him Genocide Joe. I mean, he's trying to have it both ways. He's trying to please everybody, but when you do that, you really please nobody. And I don't think they're going to come around on him. As you pointed out, middle America people, you know, middle of the road voters, swing state voters, they're not for Hamas, okay? Like, they wouldn't understand why we're abandoning our ally. I mean, if you're trying to analyze this just simply politically, I think the question you should ask yourself is, when Hamas and Iran, their backer, heard Joe Biden's announcement, do you think they were happy or sad?
Yeah, I saw you.
They're happy.
Tweet that as
Joe
well.
Biden did an interview, well, and the only people he made happy were Hamas and Iran. Everybody else was mad except for them.
Before we break, the devil's advocate side of this, and what Joe Biden would say in Milwaukee, and not on the Israel thing, but on the jobs front, is that, you know, Donald Trump went to Milwaukee and did this big groundbreaking and ended up, you know, not delivering on all the jobs that the thousands and thousands of jobs that he promised. Joe Biden is getting it done. Now, the way that Joe Biden is quote unquote getting it done is through these inflation inducing tremendous dispersals of taxpayer funding, you know, whether it's through the Inflation Reduction Act or other, you know, funding that his administration is putting out there. So there are people tapping into that money and they are building things. Do people care about the origins of how these jobs are coming about the through these tax credits and through this federal funding?
Look, I think his major problem with the economy is food prices. It's always been food prices. People are shocked when they go to the grocery. They're shocked when they go to a fast food restaurant. You know, and all presidents make claims about jobs. All presidents make claims, well, we invested this and it caused this many jobs. It's so abstract. For the individual person in your daily life, are you more worried that it just cost you $70 to take your kids to McDonald's? Or are you thinking, well, you know, I hated paying that $70 at McDonald's, but I saw some charts and graphs that made me feel
good. He agrees with you, except that he wants to blame. He's saying this is all greed on the part of corporations who are charging you more for your Snickers. And you're saying his policies are what caused inflation to happen, and which is why you don't have as much, you know, there's too much month left at the end of the bill, right?
I think the polling is pretty clear. He's taking the blame for inflation. Everybody knows that the policies they've enacted, the spending, has caused rampant inflation in this country. And I have never believed they were going to be able to sell the concept that all the corporations of America got together and had a secret meeting and decided to all raise prices at the same time. Like, it's just, it flies in the face of believability, I think, for most voters, maybe not the most partisan voters who will believe anything their side says, but for average everyday people, they look at what's going on in the country and they say, what's the president doing about it? What has he done? And do I have confidence that he could do something about it in the future? This is where Biden is falling short. I don't think the CNN interview helped him with that any. We'll see where the messaging goes from here, but we need to get to a break, Joe, because the real news of this show this week, well, there's two pieces of news. One is I have to credit you for betting on Mystic Dan to win the Kentucky Derby.
I feel a little bit better about inflation just for one week because I across the board, I picked Mystic Dan. That was my number one. And the neat thing about picking one horse and sticking with it is that you actually win money. It was good.
So congrats on that. And then number two, we have one of the greatest guests we've ever had on the podcast, Dr. Eric Smith, who is currently on leave as a professor of rhetoric at York College of Pennsylvania. He is a research fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. That's where he spoke to us from. And he is the president and co-founder of an organization, a nonprofit called Free Black Thought. He is sounding the alarm about the DEI culture and academia in corporate America. He is speaking out about this in an eloquent and powerful way. I've read some of his stuff, Joe. We talked about it in our interview. He's got an amazing op-ed in the Boston Globe, which I would encourage everyone to read. But it's Dr. Eric Smith. Joe and I have him right here after the break on Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
Hey there, Flyover Country listeners. Today's episode is brought to you by the Bluegrass Media Lab, Kentucky's premier media studio. The Bluegrass Media Lab offers a wide array of services, including video production, podcasting, live shot broadcasting, web development, media training, and more. You name it, they do it. Head over to bluegrassmedialab.com today to get in touch. Now, back to more Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
And welcome back to Flyover Country. I'm Scott Jennings. Joe Arnold is here. Thanks for listening this week. Joe, we have an amazing guest.
I'm excited.
I am as well, that we foreshadowed. Eric Smith, PhD, a research fellow at the Cato Institute, a man who is taking conservative circles by storm with some of his writing. Dr. Smith, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, a great friend of mine turned me on to some of your writing, and then I started reading it, and then I started reading some more, and I started reading some more, and I was fascinated by what you're saying and what you're willing to say, given the fact that your background is as a professor of rhetoric at York College in Pennsylvania. I know you're on a leave of absence right now to be a research fellow at the Cato Institute, but this piece you wrote in the Boston Globe, headline, "There's a Kind of Racism Embedded in DEI." If you read this, it's pretty amazing. The first thing I thought was, what in the world happened to him on the college campus among his academic ecosystem when he started to write these things and say these things? So I guess the first question is, how has all this been received? I mean, your discussions of these issues are challenging, I would suspect, 99.9% of the people that any one of us would run into on a college campus.
Well, I am definitely persona non grata in my field. My field kind of made me, in a sense. My life, my career can be split into two parts, before March of 2019 and after March of 2019. In March of 2019, there was a conference, and the keynote address featured the primary argument that it was inherently racist to expect Black students to write in standard English and to teach them standard English. They should write in their own language, quote unquote. I mean, that has all kinds of problems with it that we can unpack a little later on. But my response to that, I went on to a listserv in my field, the prominent listserv in my field, which is now defunct because of me. And I said, is this really a good idea? You know, maybe standard English will come in handy sometime in their lives, and professionally, civically, what have you. And the response to that changed right. The whole trajectory of my career. You know, I was interested in the confluence of rhetorical theory and Buddhist philosophy. You know, I was going to write books that six people read, and I was going to be fine with that. But then this happened, and my focus just totally transformed. In fact, I was writing a book at the time, and the deadline for the book was 3 months away. And I totally revamped the book to deal with, anti-racism and the semblance of empowerment that was going on in my field. I don't recommend revamping a book with 3 months left until the due date, but I had to do it. I mean, and it's you know, the upside of this, trying to find the or make the lemonade out of these lemons, is that it really sparked me and motivated me to get into these things and do all this work breakneck speed. And so I'm thankful for that. You know, I'm thankful to my haters for motivating me. You know, one of my students likes to say that haters are motivators. And I experienced that firsthand.
So given what you experienced challenging the idea that academic standards and curriculum should be changed based on someone's race, do you anticipate ever being able to go or wanting to go back into a classroom? I mean, is the ecosystem on college campuses so hostile to somebody who would challenge this sort of system that you could never teach again? I mean, how do you anticipate that unfolding for you in the future?
Well, fortunately, or unfortunately, I have tenure.
Okay.
So if I do say something that is unsavory to some people, they can't really do that much to me. There is this thing called academic freedom. However, just because I have tenure doesn't mean I, should remain in academia dealing with this stuff. I initially thought I would do just that. I'd remain in academia and try to remedy things from the inside. That is a daunting task. It proved to be a bit too much. I thought I could do more by leaving academia, rounding up the cavalry, and coming back and saving the day. That's what I'm trying to do right now. So I honestly think that I can do more to bring academia back to a more classically liberal a format from the outside and not from the inside, because the inside is that far gone.
So the academia is one ecosystem, Eric. The other is cultural, family, society. So if you're persona non grata in academia, are you persona non grata in the Black community? Because you're not defined by perhaps what people expect you to perform?
I wouldn't say the Black community. I there are a lot of people who are Black who are on my side. There are a lot of people who aren't. The people who aren't kind of stopped talking to me a couple of years ago. They rather avoid me or pretend I don't exist than actually engage with me. Which you would think I would like that, but I actually do want to engage with them. I think the engagement is what's missing. A part of the underlying ideology of contemporary DEI, critical social justice, part of that ideology is not giving the other side the time of day, right?
Right.
So it's policy almost to not talk to somebody who doesn't agree with the tenets of critical social justice. So I'm actually disappointed that nobody's coming at me a little harder, right? Because at least there'll be an interaction there.
When
Let
I
me
was
ask you. Oh, sorry, Joe. Go ahead.
I was gonna say I'm gonna age myself here. I'm older than everyone probably even listening, but I'm 57. I graduated from college in 1988, and I after going through the college tours with my two sons, who are now a sophomore in college and soon to be a freshman in college, the stark difference in what I saw and what was just kind of explained, kind of what was the expectations of college behavior was just so different. I mean, I realize now I was kind of the golden age, I guess, of academia, if you will, because I went to a college where there was truly a free exchange of ideas. There were all kinds of times I felt I definitely knew where my professors stood on things, and it might have been different than me, but I didn't feel unwelcome. I didn't. I always felt like there was a chance for you're a professor of rhetoric for an opportunity to actually exchange these things and to much better understand each other as a result. But when I walked onto some of these campuses and immediately felt like before you're even allowed to go on the tour, you have to go through the indoctrination. And there are these lectures and these kind of these semblances, okay, well, here's who we are, what we are, and if you're going to be here, you're going to play by these rules. It was it just in a world of that values free expression and free thought, it seemed to be exactly the opposite of the college that I went to a generation ago.
The issue is the difference between indoctrination and education, right? Education is here are these various theories. Let's talk about them and come to your own conclusions. Indoctrination is here's this one theory you have to abide by, and if you don't, you're in trouble. And I'm seeing that definitely in my field of rhetoric and composition, definitely. But the humanities at large is going through this, and now the sciences, and med school. You're getting this stuff in med school, which is scary, to say the least. So I don't mind these theories being around. I don't mind people talking about these theories. I don't mind people, embracing these theories wholeheartedly. I do mind the silencing of people who abide by other theories or the silencing of those theories, the conversations about those theories in the first place. So, I mean, that's the main issue here. And, you know, people like to compare, well, people I've been talking to like to compare critical social justice and a more traditional kind of, you know, classical liberal social justice, which, you know, everybody is equal, everybody is afforded the same resources and things like that. Critical social justice has no tolerance for anything other than itself. Classical liberal social justice does tolerate various viewpoints, various ways of doing things, various methodologies, and, you know, through the marketplace of ideas, come up with the best one and move on from there, right? So the intolerance is ideologically profound in contemporary DEI.
The United States and Western civilization really is sort of founded upon the idea that people can speak freely and exchange ideas, and we sort out our differences in elections and policymaking processes that exist within institutions that we, you know, all sort of agree on. But as you just pointed out, there is a growing number of people in this country, I think, who have no tolerance for sort of the foundations of how we do it and how we've done it. There's no tolerance for people who have a different point of view. And it almost immediately goes from lack of tolerance to what mechanisms can we use to silence the people that disagree with us and to make sure they have no access to these institutions. Obviously, college campuses have become notorious for this, but you can see it seeping into other institutions. Media institutions, I think, are susceptible to it, which is terrible. Do you believe that we are going to continue to see growth in this sort of authoritarian attitude of pummeling the people that are in our way and barring them from the public square? Or do you think we're reaching a tipping point where the American people are saying, you know what, enough is enough? Where do you think we are in the evolution of this experience in this country?
I think we're closer to the tipping point. And, you know, I can say that much more confidently after October 7th. The Hamas attacks and then the responses to the Hamas attacks and people actually hearing this, because there are people out there, college faculty as well as students, who will proudly tell you they're happy about the Hamas attack, you know, and that is an aspect of critical social justice, which is the undergirding philosophy of contemporary diversity, equity, and inclusion. Most initiatives anyway, there are still some people out there trying to do it right, but the people doing it wrong are too numerous.
Yeah.
So I think we are reaching that point. In fact, you can see a lot of minorities kind of walking away from the Democratic Party because of these things. They're starting to realize the strategic infantilization of people of color, by the left, the Democrats, basically. And I say Democrats and not the left, because even if a lot of Democrats don't agree with this stuff, they're not saying anything.
Right.
They're not speaking up, you know, so they might as well be consenting to it. So with the combination of people leaving the Democratic Party, minorities leaving the Democratic Party, and what we're seeing after October 7th, I think the worst is behind us. Things are still bad, but I think the worst is behind us. I think people are waking up.
You raised the concept of people in the Democratic Party who won't speak up, even though they know this is wrong. But the issue is fear. I mean, people fear for what would happen to them, which sort of proves the point, which what do you have to be afraid of? I mean, obviously, they know what there is to be afraid of, which is immediate ostracization and cancellation and, you know, being banished, you know, from your group. So they would have no reason to fear if they didn't know what was immediately awaiting them on the other side, which is what I think makes your work so remarkable, is that you appear to have no fear whatsoever about raising these issues in a culture that has made it quite clear, if you stick your head up out of the ditch, we will shoot it off. I mean, particularly for African Americans in this country who challenge the liberal, progressive, or Marxist orthodoxy on this, there is immediate repercussions. And I tend to agree with you that we're reaching a tipping point, and you raise the issue of politics. And we're seeing it in the polling. You know, we talk about this on CNN a lot, and obviously we're looking at the national polls between Biden and Trump. You can see African Americans starting to migrate back to Donald Trump a little bit, which, you know, in some ways makes some sense. I mean, most African Americans are working class people. Right. Working class Americans are generally migrating towards Trump right now. But I do think there is something going on with the idea that people are being tired of being ordered. What do you have to believe and what do you have to say? And if you get out of line, we're coming for you. Like, I think people ultimately will throw those shackles off, and this election may be the, you know, maybe the beginning of that.
Yeah, perhaps. You know, you say that I'm brave for speaking out about these things and you know, potentially alienating myself from my academic peers, for example. I was already invisible, you know, in my field. I was a Black person who wasn't focusing on Black things. Mm-hmm. I wasn't doing Black rhetoric. I was doing rhetoric, right? I wasn't doing Black Buddhist philosophy. I was doing Buddhist philosophy. And somebody like that just isn't seen, you know? So I didn't matter anyway. You know, if you want to be known, and you're a person of color, especially Black, you have to, your work has to focus on, quote unquote, the Black experience. And I wasn't doing that. So it's not like, you know, I didn't really lose friends. I didn't have them in the first place. You know what I mean? As far as respect in my field is concerned, or even acknowledgement in my field is concerned. So I didn't have much to lose, in my opinion.
I would think, though, that other Black academics would rally to this, in the sense that if you are being marginalized by your race in academia in the first place, as to say you must follow this narrow path and only look at things through the prism of race versus what the field is, wouldn't that ultimately be marginalizing and confining as an academic?
Yes, it would be. And I think people are okay with that. I mentioned earlier critical social justice, which is the problem. You know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, those terms are fine. It's going to be hard to find people who don't like those terms individually. But the undergirding philosophy is critical social justice, whose primary tenet is this. The question isn't, did something racist happen? Is how did it manifest in this situation? Which is to say, something racist is always already happening when you're interacting interracially. Somehow, this podcast is racist. You just haven't figured it out yet because we haven't been trained in critical social justice, right? This idea that there is an oppressor and an oppressed, and that dynamic cannot change. The idea that Western civilization was created for the sole purpose of maintaining white supremacy, these are the things that are undergirding critical social justice. So when, and everybody is defined by their group affiliation and not who they are as an individual, right? So if that's the case, if you get more clout for group affiliation, you're going to play up that group affiliation, which means that you're going to happily pigeonhole yourself in academia. It gives you more clout, more ethos.
Let me ask you a question about the DEI programming that exists in higher education. It's obviously widespread. It's unchecked. And I think many times it's taught by individuals who may check a box, like a racial box, but they don't really check box on competence. They don't check box on their own background, their diversity of experience. They don't have a much perspective beyond this idea that everyone must be trained to find the racism.
Right.
I was interested in your background. I mean, you had an interesting story to tell in your Boston Globe article about how you grew up and the different experiences you had, the people you were in touch with and went to school with. I mean, obviously, you bring a lot of worldly experience into the formulation of your viewpoints today. Am I right in thinking, though, that a lot of the people that administer the DEI programming completely lack, you know, the diversity of experience, professional, personal, and otherwise, and that therefore their entire worldview is tucked into this little box of what they've been told they have to enforce on a college campus?
I think the biggest issue is that a lot of these companies who are outsourcing their DEI training aren't vetting, you know, the people that are hiring. Ever since George Floyd, everybody's been like, okay, we just need somebody to do this. You know, right. They'll grab the first person they see. They'll Google something and grab the first hit, you know, or something like that. And that's been problematic precisely because there was also people who abide by critical social justice saw a window of opportunity after the George Floyd incident and kind of flooded this industry, right? DEI or diversity work wasn't always so inundated by critical social justice. It was a lot more classically liberal. You know, Martin Luther King didn't hate classical liberal values. He was upset that Black people weren't allowed to enjoy them, right? So he wanted to keep them, right? Critical social justice is, it doesn't like classical liberal values. It thinks those values are a front. You know, it thinks those values are helping to perpetuate racism and white supremacy, right? It's a trick. So very different from what we heard in the 60s, the civil rights movement and things like that. This is something very different. Unfortunately, when people hire diversity workers, they're assuming, you know, it's something more in line with the 60s civil rights movement. And they couldn't be more wrong.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're going to do this stuff, and a lot of people do it because it covered their ground, you know, covered their bases rather, legally, right? If you're going to do this, vet the people you're hiring, right? Look into what they're doing, right? Don't just defer to them because they're the experts. Look into this. Ask around. I don't know. Do something. Because contemporary DEI is problematic.
Well, my assumption is that a lot of companies after George Floyd that felt like they needed to do something, it was essentially a conversation that went something like this. The employees expect us to do something. What can we do to do something but not think too deeply about it or spend too much of our day on it? And so, like you said, they wind up not vetting. They don't spend any time thinking it through. My assumption is this, like many industries, is subject to some grifting. You know, you get people who claim to be an expert. I mean, look, I'm in politics. Believe me, there's plenty of grifters in politics. I mean, if you just went on the internet and hired the first political consultant you found, you probably wouldn't find a very good one. And so it is amazing to me that these largest companies in the world wound up throwing all this money and time into this and spent no time thinking through, well, how's this going to affect our company? How, you know, are these people know what they're doing? What happens on the backside of this when they teach our employees that, you know, Western civilization is bad and capitalism should be destroyed? Well, you know, I mean, it might have an impact on a company that's a for-profit corporation.
Yeah.
But I've heard from some people in corporate America, though, that I think we have already passed the tipping point on this. They have, a lot of folks have come to realize this was a terrible idea, and now they're trying to figure out how to unwind it without, you know, making people angry. So they got themselves into a mess. Now they're trying to get out of it. But I guess the silver lining is at least they realize, oh, we may have created a mess here. I mean, I don't doubt their intentions were good, at least at the beginning, but the mess did not meet the moment.
Yeah. I mean, we have to come to terms with the fact that DEI is a multi-billion dollar industry, right? And if you are doing well in that industry, the last thing you want is for racism to go away. You know, you got to, racial justice isn't going to put their kids through college, right? Yeah. They got to ramp up the racism, which means that the tenet that I talked about earlier about critical social justice, racism is always happening. It makes sense now, right? I mean, you got to push that if you want to maintain this industry. Sadly, not a lot of people look at diversity work the way I do. I see diversity as what I call a sacrificial industry. And what I mean by that is if you are truly doing this work and you're doing it in good faith, your goal should be to put yourself out of a job as soon as possible, right? That should be the way things are going. That's not the way things are going. If you abide by critical social justice, you'll always have a job because racism will always be here. It's not going away. The best we can do is manage it, right? So I mean, that's one of the biggest issues, I think, with DEI. That is, it's such a lucrative business. People don't want to let go of it.
Too big to fail.
Yeah.
Fail.
When I read you writing about this, it reminded me, I guess in my head, I don't know if it's an apt metaphor or analogy or not, is labor unions, you know, so much of what they fought for was legitimate, you know, especially, you know, throughout the industrialization of America. But so many, the good news is that many of the things they fought for, you know, have become law. They've codified. You know, and so as a result, that's a good thing, and that we have those kind of protections and those safety things that are in place. But you still need to have grievances to keep the unions in shape. Is that a good comparison or not?
I guess so. I guess when I think of unions, I guess I don't think of unions. But now that I'm thinking of unions, I often assume that there is always an issue, so they always have something to do. I didn't think they had to fabricate things as much as, you know, a DEI person might have to fabricate things.
Right.
I didn't realize that.
Well, I'm just saying some of the safety things over the years. The other thing I want to ask you about is, if I could, is to follow up on one thing that you said a moment ago. And I made a note of it because I've never heard those two words together before. You said strategic infantilization. What do you mean by that?
Well, how do I begin it? So many ways to begin this explanation, but I'll say this. If you convince people that the world is against them and that only you can save them, you know, if you succeed in convincing them of that, then you're going to get their votes, for one thing. If you infantilize somebody, you're basically, you're the parent, right? It's paternalistic in nature. Right. So if you convince people that they always need to cut corners, they always need the rules changed for them, specifically for them. Right. If you convince people that, you know, Black kids, they can't do math. So we have to teach them differently. Right. If you convince people that no matter what you do, when you go out there, the racism is going to get you, right? Then suddenly they lack agency, they lack confidence, and they need your help, right? Learned helplessness is another way of saying strategic infantilization, right? If you convince these people that they are helpless, you can convince them that you are needed and you can maintain your power.
I want to ask you about another word you brought up, this idea of microaggressions. And in one of your writings, you made note that in the Harvard Business Review, the concept that the most qualified person should get the job was considered to be a microaggression. And flowing from what you just said, the idea that we have to change the curriculum for certain people, or the idea that we have to change the rules, and then flowing into the business world where someone might call you racist or say you've committed a microaggression by saying, well, maybe we should just hire the best and most qualified person. How pervasive is it? I mean, we see these things. I know college campuses are a little different than I'm trying to get my mind around how pervasive it is that these concepts, which sound crazy to me, but are being effectively internalized and institutionalized throughout society. And that's step one. How pervasive is it? And step two, if it's so pervasive, is it too hard to take it out? Is it too hard to yank it out at this point? Or are we still able to do that, you think?
I'll say this. The I in DEI, inclusion, it doesn't really mean everybody feels like they belong. When you look at that word through the lens of critical social justice, it means there are things you can't say, because if you offend somebody, then they feel like they don't belong. Therefore, you're in trouble, right? So, I mean, and that kind of makes sense on a surface level, but then you think about it. People are offended by different things, right? That microaggression you just mentioned, that the most qualified person should get the job, I'm not offended by that. I'm supposed to be,
right?
But I'm not. So, and
what comes with it is a presumption that you couldn't possibly be the most qualified person.
Right. Yes.
Which I would think would be offensive to someone, you know, I mean, if that statement is a microaggression, effectively what you're saying is that no person of color could ever possibly be the most qualified. Therefore, it's so obvious that that in and of itself is a racist statement, but I guess they don't see it that way.
And there's always a mistrust, expectation of coded language. So when somebody says the most qualified person should get the job, a critical social justice proponent will hear white people should get the job, right? Because that's what he really means, right?
Right.
So there's that going on as well. So you ask how pervasive it is. Well, that depends on how well companies are vetting their diversity officers, their outsourced diversity trainers. Or things like that. If it truly is inclusion, that's one thing. But if it's the critical social justice inclusion, that's very different. So, I mean, I guess in academia, it's basically, the bricks and the mortar, of the place. You know, I mean, you can't get away from it there. And it's taken very seriously. I don't know how pervasive it is in corporate America, but it's not innocuous in any way, I don't think. I don't think the effect is negligible at all. But I think when people realize what DEI, contemporary DEI, really means, they might start to back up a little bit. And that includes minorities. I want to make that clear. There are a lot of, Black people, Hispanic people who think this is stupid too, right?
Right.
Charlemagne Tha God from the Breakfast Club went on The Daily Show, I think, and called it stupid, right? I forget the actual term he said. I think he said load of crap or something. but yeah, I mean, it's Black people are starting to realize what this really is and how insulting it is and how infantilizing it is, right? And they're saying to themselves, well, sometimes I'm the most qualified person. How come nobody's thinking that?
My role on the podcast often, Eric, is just to frustrate Scott and to be the devil's advocate on some things. So first of all, racism exists.
Yeah.
You know, the question is, I guess, what should be done, if you will, or what do you recommend, or what is your vision for, I guess the number one, I should ask you this: to what extent is that a matter for government or institutions or anything to attack or to approach? And then what would be the right way for us to go about this? Because I appreciate, even though I don't disagree with you in terms of what the downsides of the DEI dogma is, I appreciate consciousness. I appreciate being made aware of maybe my own biases that I may have been raised with. And then as I've gotten older, maybe I've become more confident in myself that I can appreciate the fact that I'm also prone to prejudice in my own life. So I guess my question is, what is the best way for us to move forward as a country if this is not the way to go with DEI?
A lot of people think I'm overly stoic, I guess, when I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I don't care as much about what you think as what you do, right? I can't, police your thoughts. I shouldn't police your thoughts. What you think of me is none of my business. However, if you act on a negative thought about me and somehow impede my ability to move upward or acquire my goals or something like that, then we have a problem. So it really is about policy, not ambiguous policy, right? It is about policy and making sure that people do the right things, even if they're not thinking the right things. For example, with the ambiguity of policy, right? You're not allowed to say anything that could be construed as sexist or racist. People have different interpretations of what those words mean, right? We just talked about the microaggression of the most qualified person. I'm not offended by that. Somebody else may be, right? So it's hard to say something like, you can't say a single thing that offends somebody because anything could offend somebody. I once had a friend who was mad at me because she had a fight with her dad that day, and I was wearing a similar shirt.
Oh my God.
This was years ago, but I mean, I always think of that when I think of microaggressions because you never know what's going to bother somebody,
Yeah, right.
right? So we have to have clear, unambiguous policy, and we have to stop being worried about the subconscious thoughts people have.
Joe, you said that your view is racism exists. I want to ask a short and simple question to you, Eric. Does systemic racism exist in this country? Because that is the term that you most often hear in media discussions and that you most often hear people throw out. This police department suffers from systemic racism, or the United States government was founded on systemic racism, or it goes on and on and on. I'm interested in your view of the idea of racism, but then more than that, this concept that systemic racism has infected virtually everything, and therefore it should be torn down and we should start over.
That's tough because I get that idea to an extent, right? But I think it's taken way too far. Systemic racism basically says that, it's racism is intertwined into every institution in America, if not Western civilization. I think that's a bit of an overstatement. A lot of the rationale for that is what's called a genetic fallacy. When these ideas were thought up, things were very racist. So the ideas themselves are still racist, although it's 2024 now, right? That's a genetic fallacy. And a lot of accusations of systemic racism are that, right? The person who came up with this idea was racist, so the idea is racist, right? It's that silly. That being said, I mean, I get when people are like, this school is systemically racist because American history is a requirement, but Black American history is an elective, right? Or something like that. I mean, I kind of get that. I think Black American history should be in American history, but that's a different conversation altogether. So I get it to a degree. I get it when people see the disparities between races and go straight to the assumption that it must be racism that's doing it. But if you look closely, there are a lot of other factors going on. Ian Rowe just well last year wrote a book called Agency, right? Which to me is the opposite of infantilization. And he says it's not just racism. There are issues with family. There's a lack of a religious or spiritual component to people's lives, a lack of knowledge and entrepreneurship, which I think is a huge and something we should be addressing foremost right now, right? And obviously education. So all these things come into play as well. And I think if we focus on those things, we can improve a lot of things. So if systemic racism was real and we focused on those things and they end up working, then it wasn't real, right? Because if they were real, nothing would work because everything's systemically racist. So, I mean, it's kind of contradictory that a lot of diversity officers will abide by systemic racism, and which basically says, everything's racist, it's not going away, right? It kind of contradicts what they're doing. I'm here to fight racism that's never going away. I'm here to get rid of something that can't be gotten rid of, right? So that and many other contradictions are rampant in contemporary DEI. But that's why I think the systemic racism thing is tricky, because I get it, but I think it's an overstatement.
You mentioned religion in your previous comments, and I have wondered sometimes when I look out at the landscape of America right now, what's going on the college campuses with the protests, what goes on with DEI, what goes on with people in the who are very committed to the transgender ideology, people who are very committed to the climate ideology. I mean, you see these pillars pop up, almost all of it on the progressive left. And I do wonder if some of it is just a replacement for religion. I mean, we're not as religious. We don't have those systems that kind of inform us or give us a sense of community and values. And I wonder if people are just searching for something to replace it with. I mean, it's human nature to want to have those kinds of systems. Is that what you sense? Is that the loss of our religious infrastructure has been replaced by some of these other infrastructures that perhaps are not conducive to a healthy culture in the United States right now?
Yes. And other people think this as well. John McWhorter wrote a book about it, right? This isn't like a religion, it's a religion,
right?
Is what he says. Prefiguration is a religious concept. You're acting out, you know, kind of, or you're seeing something that is a harbinger of things to come, or you're acting something out for a world that's to come, right? John the Baptist prefigured Jesus, right? So prefigurative politics is when you create the world you want to see in your particular environment. Occupy Wall Street was this. They right. created encampments that was the world they wanted to see, you know, knowing that the real world wasn't like this, but we're going to model what we want to see and do our best to bring it to light, to bring it to reality. And academia, however, that happens. Prefiguration happens, but they stop there. You know, we're just going to pretend this college campus is the world we want to see. Right. We're going to not acknowledge that outside world. And if somebody reminds me of that outside world, I'm going to punish them somehow. Right. So there is that. Right. The over embrace of prefigurative politics. You're supposed to do that and then go back into the real world. You're not supposed to stay there. Right. Secondly, I mean, there are aspects of academia that, you know, were formerly just seen in congregations. Right. There are sacred texts. There are books you can't critique.
Right.
And if you do, there's something wrong with you. Right. critical inquiry, especially if it's a person of color you're asking or talking to or disagreeing about an idea. That's considered anathema. Right. For the same, especially leaders in the field to critique them is anathema. Think about it. When you're in church, you don't stand up and say, Pastor, I don't agree with your interpretation of John 3:16. I think you're overstating the issue. You don't do that, right? You will be kicked out. Now academia is that.
Right.
You know, if you do that, you will be kicked out, quote unquote. So it is very much religion, in my opinion.
If that's the case, and I don't disagree that it is, and I'm by the way, there's a op-ed by Christopher Rufo that's making the rounds here in Kentucky about the University of Kentucky and the racialist ideology, as he puts it, you know, going on there. But since this is generational now, and because this has been in place for a long time, and academia has, I think, pretty much drummed out those other voices that would challenge what you're talking about, or would raise their hand and say, I disagree with this. I don't know how much hope I should have that it's possible to begin to reform and kind of get back to the free market idea or the free thought that universities were founded upon. I mean, do you have a pathway here for a University of Kentucky, for instance? What's the best way to unwind from that way of thinking and to welcome in different voices? Is it possible?
And before you answer, I want to add one addendum to that question. Is it the Yes. responsibility of our politics, our politicians, and our government structures to enforce this unwinding? Because we had this debate here, and ultimately they didn't do anything, the legislature, and they're having this debate in many states. But in your mind, is the unwinding here only going to be occurring if our political structures enforce it?
Well, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, 13 states have passed anti-DEI legislation. Mm-hmm. Divisive concepts is what is ultimately against. A lot of the language is lifted seemingly verbatim from Trump's executive order, saying basically the same thing at a federal level. And some of these bills are well written, some of them not so much.
Right.
Utah is one that says, you know what, we don't want these divisive concepts, but you can talk about critical social justice. You can talk about it in class. You just can't force people to abide by it, right? Not every state's clear on that aspect. You read some of them, and it's like, oh my God, I can't say black anymore. It's the way it reads, So they're not all made the same, but a lot of those bills go into, I guess, I think they all start this year at some point, 2024, and we'll see what happens there. But ultimately, I think, especially with public institutions, I think the people should know what's going on, and I don't know if we should publish syllabi or something like that, or have people get up in front of the faculty or the town hall and explain what they do in the classroom or something like that. I don't know. But I think if people saw what was going on, they'd have a problem with it. A lot of people assume, that a liberal arts college is just that, liberal arts. That's not really the case these days. And people just don't know.
I think you're raising the critical issue here about the future of higher education. And that is when parents start to figure out what's going on these college campuses, they may stop sending their kids there. I mean, these demonstrations post October the 7th. I mean, I think these Ivy League schools, and I've taught a class at the Kennedy School for several semesters, and I think these Ivy League schools are playing with fire when it comes to, I mean, I think for so long they've just believed, well, our brand will carry us forward no matter what we do. But I mean, there's a lot of American parents right now whose dream was to send their kid to an Ivy League college until they saw what's going on over the last few months. But if what happened, if what you prescribe happens, the publication of syllabi, the sort of the making public everything that's going on a daily basis outside of the encampment culture, parents, I think, would wonder, what am I paying $90,000 a year to send my kid to marinate in this idea that Western civilization needs to be destroyed? Like, is that what I want him to come home with? I think there'd be a revolt by parents. And I know you've been very generous with your time, and we can leave it here. But do you believe colleges understand that they're on the brink? I believe it. I think higher education is on the brink of being upended as we've known it in this country, precisely for the issues you've raised.
If I'm not mistaken, MIT just banned diversity statements and applications. So that's a step in the right direction. And other elite institutions may follow suit. A lot of parents would be up in arms if they knew what was going on. A lot of them find out the hard way when it's too late, like Thanksgiving dinner. It's too late by then. I honestly think, I'll say this again. I know I sound like a broken record here, but I think we just need to expose this stuff. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, and I think that's the case here too. We just got to get the word out there. Diversity, equity, inclusion is not what you think. I don't know if Martin Luther King would like this stuff. You gotta realize this. Think about it a little bit, and then we can see what happens.
Eric, you mentioned, of course, your work at the Cato Institute, CATO, for those less familiar. Where else can we find you? Where else can we follow you? Where can we read you?
Well, I co-founded a nonprofit called Free Black Thought. The purpose of this organization is to let people know that Black Americans aren't a monolith. We're individuals, we're diverse. Some of us are going to vote for Biden, some of us are going to vote for Trump. If you listen to mainstream media, we're all voting for Biden, and that's just not the case. So this website kind of draws attention to that. It has a journal that publishes authors that may not get a voice in mainstream media, right? Because they have an idea of what blackness is supposed to be, apparently. We have a podcast as well. We're working on some K through 12 curricula to combat the Black Lives Matter in schools movement. And there's a lot going on there. So please check it out. It's www.freeblackthought.com. There's a lot there.
We'll be promoting that on our social channels here.
That's a great word of free, by the way. I know you mean that. I know you mean it in every iteration. So it's very inspiring, Eric. Thank you.
Before you go, I have just a little bit of a political question to ask you before we go. And you've raised it with the idea of, you know, do all black people have to vote for Democrats? Do you think over the last few decades, the cause of, and when I say cause, I mean the economic fortunes of the, you know, the quality of life fortunes of African-Americans and people of color in this country, do you think it's been set back by the fact that one political party has dominated that vote and then ultimately taken it for granted?
Yes.
I mean, and if you believe that, which it sounds like you do you believe that African-Americans and it sounds like from the polling that I see, even Hispanics now and others, do you think people are waking up to that, that it's better not to be a monolith? It's better to have people scattered across the political spectrum. It gives you more coverage and more influence in our policymaking. It's kind of shocking to me that it's taken this long for people to come to this realization.
Well, it's taken this long because Democrats have done something very well. They said, we're all you have. You may not like us, but the other side hates you.
Right.
Right. So you got to, and they did that very well, very convincingly, apparently. But the persuasive nature of that tactic is waning, in my opinion. I think people are starting to open their eyes and see that it's in their best interest to have us afraid of the other side, obviously, right? So we should start thinking for ourselves.
Dr. Eric Smith, he is currently on leave as a professor of rhetoric at York College in Pennsylvania. He speaks to us today from the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., where he is a research fellow. And as you just heard him describe, he is the president and co-founder of Free Black Thought. That's E-R-E-C Smith. I promise you, if you type it into the Google, if you type it into YouTube, if you type it in anywhere, you're going to find some amazing things, some excellent writing, some civil discourse, which we sorely need in this country, all from the mind of Dr. Eric Smith. You've been a great guest. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Flyover Country. I'm Scott. He's Joe. Catch you next week. Flyover Country with Scott Jennings is a production of Bluegrass Media Lab, coming to you from the heart of Middle America, Louisville, Kentucky. If you like what you heard, subscribe to Flyover Country on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.